and welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. We are once again being brought to you by High Octane Damnation, and at the close of the show, I'll read you some more awesome blurbs about that one. We are here with Joshua Newitt, author of the book Saving Bill Murray, which you only have to hear the title to know that you want to read it. Am I right? This is Renee, and I'm drinking a Shiner Hefeweizen, which I didn't know that Shiner made anything besides Bock, but they make a Hefeweizen, and it's quite nice. Joshua, how are you doing, and what are you drinking?
I am drinking a coffee. It's just about noon here in South Korea, so I'm having a Korean coffee stick.
Nice. Exciting. And what? How is that different from just, like, coffee?
Oh, it's just like powdered coffee that comes in, you know, like a stick.
Oh.
You dump it in the water. They're crazy for them here.
Huh. Jessica, what are you having? Does it come in powder form?
It does not, which is kind of a shame. No, I'm having a PBR tonight. It's cold, though. It came out of the fridge, so.
That's nice.
Yeah.
My Shiner's a little bit warm because I was actually finishing another beer first.
Mm. See, I haven't even really started yet.
Oh, you guys are making me jealous.
It's going to be awkward.
I wish I had started earlier. Let's be real. So I guess, like, let's just get this out of the way. You mentioned you're in Korea. I feel like our listeners at home are going, well, he doesn't sound Korean. So do you want to give us a little bit of background on that, like get people warmed up a little bit before
we
dive in?
Sure. I came to Korea 6 years ago. Just got sick with, you know, doing, like, the 9-to-5 lifestyle. And worked for a publishing company selling, like, marketing packages, trying to hawk marketing packages to authors. And I just wanted to do something different, so I narrowed it down to joining the French Foreign Legion or teaching abroad. And, you know, I picked teaching abroad, of course. The French Foreign Legion was too dangerous, and here I am.
Do you mind if I ask what drew you to the French Foreign Legion as an option in the first place?
Well, you know, the sense of romance, adventure. I think it was a Frank Sinatra movie where he joins the French Foreign Legion.
All right. I'll take it. Saving Bill Murray. I know, like, I don't even remember how I stumbled across this book on Amazon. But, of course, the title jumps out. And then I read the synopsis. It's basically like this young man has a vision and feels that he is called by God to save Bill Murray's soul.
Yes.
And hijinks ensue, basically, in a nutshell, right? So my very first response was, like, I want to read that book, and I need to get this guy on the podcast. Like, that's it. I didn't know anything else. Nothing. So aside from the fact that Bill Murray is just pretty awesome, and it's going to be fun to write anything that touches on that,
right.
How did you, this book is really, like, I don't want to sell it short. It's really complex, and there's a lot of things going on. And it's not, I don't know that I would call it easy reading, but it's really fun. So
right.
When you're putting all this together, like, what, I guess, if there is a way that you could pinpoint, like, the inspiration for the overall story,
Yeah, the overall story, I wanted to, you know, all of my work usually makes a commentary on our postmodern condition, you know, what it means to be living in the postmodern era, and how hard it is sometimes to relate to other people, you know. I also wanted to make a commentary on religious zealotry, but I didn't want to do it from, you know, a preachy point of view that was too sophomoric or damning towards religion. I wanted to paint a picture of these guys who were, you know, easy to relate to and you could understand and sympathize with and kind of see things from their point of view before they got carried away, you know, kind of sympathize with them, try to see things from a different angle. And I wanted to make the point that you can have religion and be religious without being a zealot, so to speak. I mean,
right.
in America, like over here, you don't have, it's not like a politically charged topic, you know, like it is in America. And I didn't really realize that until I left the country, you know, and I wanted to kind of speak to that in the book.
I think it's really interesting because for listeners who haven't read the book, there's kind of three storylines that intersect about midway through the book. And you kind of know that, I mean, you know that they are going to intersect, but they're very different stories. And within those stories, there's also other stories about things that people are going through. And it seems to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that just about every character in this book is in a place where they really need to come to terms with who they are. The most glaring example would be the Donald character, and I don't want to give anything away, but he has some like minor scarring that he thinks makes him hideously ugly, because he was just used to being like almost supernaturally handsome before, and then he has this minor scarring that in his head is like fully disfigured, and everybody in the room is looking at it, and everybody else is like, "Man, like that's kind of crazy. You look fine, you know."
Yeah.
So I guess it's obvious, like, religion is something that people turn to when they're trying to figure out, you know, what their lives mean, or, you know, trying to do some soul searching. But not everybody in the book turns to religion. And I think it is interesting, I guess, the way that they all sort of end up together in the end. But I guess I was wondering what your commentary is on this sort of condition of needing to confront ourselves and having like a false idea of who we are or what our lives mean or whatever.
Right, right. That was definitely a theme, you know, I wanted to get across in the book. Just that we all delude ourselves to some level or another, you know. And by realizing we do that and analyzing that, we can grow as people.
Right.
I think.
So here's some. Okay, this is a more fun question because I feel like it got deep really fast. I feel like, you know, beards are a huge deal right now. I just saw an article, like no shit, an hour and a half ago about how men are paying top dollar for beard transplants so they can have a beard.
Oh yeah.
I'm like, red beard hair goes for like a ton of money because it's so rare.
Red beard hair?
Yeah, like, because, you know, if you have, like, there's not a lot of redheaded guys out there, and not all redheaded people have red beards, so that it's so hard to get your hands on.
Oh, that's crazy.
But do you...
What are you going to say?
Oh, that's so weird. Okay.
It is really weird, right?
Yeah. I think in, was it Iraq? They have mustache transplants as well.
You know, I had heard about that.
You know, it's a sign of masculinity.
Yeah. Oh, that's so strange. I almost kind of
like
it, that at least there's some, like, out there in the world, there's some equivalent to what women have to face for the for their standard of beauty. No, you have to have a mustache transplant.
Have you seen the guys with the bicep transplants? They're fucking creepy.
Mm.
They're
it's like
really
the oil,
like
the oil they inject.
I don't even know. I know I read about the people who've like injected all kinds of weird shit, and you know, like their arms explode and they die.
Yeah,
which is pretty scary. But I've also seen ones that are supposedly just implants. I don't know what's in them. All I know is I look at those dudes and I'm like, what the? It doesn't look human anymore. Like nobody's arms are shaped like that.
Yeah, that becomes an issue.
Anyway, this got weird fast, but for everyone at home that's like, and one of the characters starts out the novel like he's so lost and purposeless. He's, you know, son of a wealthy man, doesn't have to really do anything for his life, and he decides to like grow his beard for 100 days and keep a blog about it. And I thought that was great. Like, that's like finger on the pulse stuff right there. Like, I would be astounded if there wasn't someone in, like, Portland or Berkeley or Austin doing that exact thing right now.
Are there many bearded guys where you live?
Well, yeah. I live right near a military base, so not where I live.
It's kind of trendy now, though. That's sort of a thing.
You know, you're right. All the contractors that I know that are like, you know, they're not, maybe they used to be in the military, but now they just work for the military. All of those guys have beards.
Hmm.
I feel like they do it to tease, like, haha, I can have a beard and you can't. Boss will yell at you.
Yeah. They don't grow beards over here. Beards are considered dirty in Korea.
Hmm.
Really? That's interesting.
That. Yeah, so if you have a beard, they'll look at you and say, oh, dirty guy.
Is that, well, see, now you mention that, I'm like, oh, my God, like, my eyes have been opened. I never really thought about it before, but when you look at you know, photos and or see, like, news stories, people in Asian countries, like, you genuinely do not see beards.
Yeah.
And it never occurred to me before that, like, maybe there was a reason.
Yeah. Yeah, in Korea for sure. They're frowned upon.
Oh.
God, that blew me away. You don't even understand. Like, especially because they're so, like, it's such a big deal in the U.S. right now. Like, everybody has to have a beard. And like there are people who genuinely, like, I know one of the characters in the book, like, has a handlebar mustache that he waxes.
Yeah.
Like, that really happens here. Like, people do, like, beard growing contests, and they wax their beards to match their mustaches. Like, I met a guy at a concert who had, like, an outdoor festival concert, who had a fully waxed curled mustache. And I was just like, what is this?
Like, why is this happening?
Yeah, it's weird.
So do you think that most females dislike beards?
I don't like them. But
I'm okay with it. It depends. Like, nothing, not over the top or scary. You know, scary.
It should look like something lives in it.
Right.
I feel like it's a thing, like guys love it. You know, guys, when another guy's growing a beard, you're like, oh, yeah, that's great. That's so cool. But women always seem to, you know, ugh.
Yeah, just be clean, you know, yeah.
I have at least one friend who loves beards. He's, like, super into beards. She's married to a guy with a fantastic beard. I don't know, you know. But,
good.
Yeah, she's super into him. But as a general, like, I don't know. But here's the thing, right? Like, guys also think that the size of their penis matters a lot. But, like, I keep reading these articles that are, like, when women were questioned, they were like, well, let's not get crazy. I don't want to get hurt.
Yeah.
You know? So I feel like guys just, like, in a way, it is like, you know, women, they say women dress for women more than they dress for men. I think, like, men grow their beards and lie about their penis size for men more than they do it
right.
for women.
Right.
Hmm.
Maybe other things, too, but those are the two examples I came up with right off the top of my head.
Yeah.
So, okay, this was exciting for me, and because I literally, I took pictures of my notes and sent them to Jessica, I bet you that she has no idea what I'm about to talk about. I bet you do.
Oh.
Because you read something of mine that talks about it.
I'm lost, but go ahead.
Yeah, we'll get there. So, there's a dinner club in the book, and in one of the scenes they're talking about Ray Kurzweil's writing on the singularity.
Oh, sure.
And that was super exciting to me because I recently got into, like, paying attention to him. And Kurzweil is such a fascinating person, but then his ideas about the singularity are, like, at once extremely fascinating and extremely terrifying. And I thought it was cool because that was sort of the debate in the book. Is that everybody is sort of like, ooh, I don't know. And everybody took a different position on it. So I feel like it's obvious that you've read it, because how else would you manage to come up with all these different opinions on it for these people in the dinner club? So what is your thought on the singularity and like human evolution? And
yeah, I agree with you totally. I mean, I think it's super fascinating, and when you first come across it, it's really scary, you know, because it kind of challenges the way that you think about the definition of humanity, you know, what we are as humans. And like he said, it took him a long, long time to come to terms with it himself, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's scary. It's scary, I think. But I think the more you read his work and stuff, the more feasible it seems, you know?
I think it's like super, like, for anybody who really wants like an introduction to Kurzweil, I could totally suggest watching The Transcendent Man, the documentary. Because you get an introduction to him realizing that he really is, like, he's a legitimate genius. Mm. And then you hear all like the theories he has that sound like pretty cuckoo pants at first. But what I thought was really crazy about him is, like, he takes, like, 100 supplements a day or something like that. And most people are like, okay, whatever, good for you, but supplements aren't going to make that big of a difference. But they stood him next to his wife, and his wife is like, whatever, I don't take supplements. And they're the same age, but they look like she's like 20 or 30 years older. It was mind-blowing.
Yeah.
I was like, maybe he's just gifted genetically, but the visual is so striking. I mean, I didn't go buy it. Like, he sells the supplements. I didn't go buy any, but I was impressed.
Yeah, I think it was 200, over 200 pills a day, I think, it said he takes, right?
Yeah,
something,
it was something ridiculous.
Like,
and none of them are for illness. They're all, like, he doesn't have any chronic illnesses or anything. They're all, like, brain supplements and skin supplements because he's trying to preserve his youth as much as possible because he believes that, like, you know, the singularity is coming. We're going to merge with the robots, and he wants to be around for it.
Yeah.
I feel like that would take, like, a whole hour out of my day to take that many pills.
To take that many pills, I know. But, yeah. I mean, like, he's out there inventing shit, and he works for Google, and he runs a supplement company, and he makes movies and writes books. I feel like, you know, he's obviously pretty efficient. He somehow, managed to schedule the pill-taking in such a way that... that he can still be productive. Maybe one of the pills is speed.
Oh, true. Like, there's some vitamins, like, oh, you shouldn't take that at night because it'll give you leg cramps or something. How do you suss all that out if you're taking that many at once? How do you know which one's bothering you?
Yeah, who knows?
Wow.
I worry about too much stuff, but...
Yeah, well, because now I'm like, wow, that would suck.
It would. That's intense.
Like, if you just, like, if you start getting itchy and you're like, oh, shit, I'm allergic to one of these.
I'm allergic to one of these.
Developed an allergy to something.
And then it turns out it's your laundry detergent.
Right. It wasn't the pills at all. Because, you know, what they say, like, when you have an allergy, like, you eliminate... everything that it might be and add them back one at a time. It would take him like a year to realize that it was the laundry detergent.
Meanwhile, it's like a Lazarus pit and he ages drastically all of a sudden.
he looks like he's 110.
Yeah.
Sounds like a good book.
Oh, God.
Fucking tied the whole time.
I have no idea. It's like that ending scene of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade where the guy drinks from the wrong cup. All of a sudden, bones, because he didn't take his supplements.
And that would be like on day three, right? Like,
absolutely, day three, yeah. This seriously just reminded me to go take a vitamin, though. So, like, I need my vitamins. Yeah, why not? I'm not that guy. I only take one vitamin. It's okay. Anyway.
So I'm flipping through my notes, and actually, like, I feel like my favorite quote from the whole book was the guy, I gave the brief description of the book, but the guy who feels like his calling in life is to save Bill Murray's soul is a guy named Ryan, and his best friend is David. And I guess one of the central conflicts of the story is that David doesn't really believe in anything that is going on, but is going on this crazy adventure with Ryan because he's, like, genuinely fucking worried that his friend is losing it and that he's becoming, also, that he's becoming a dick, which I thought was kind of funny. There's a part where he's like, well, if he lost into, like, some weird archaeological interest, who cares? But to be, like, a total, like, religious fanatic jerk, God, that's horrible. So David says, maybe you are confusing the awesomeness of Bill Murray with God. I mean, we were watching Ghostbusters, which is one of your favorites. Maybe you were overcome by the power and genius of Murray and wanted to somehow believe destiny intertwined your fates. I mean, who wouldn't want to believe that? So I'm going to go out on a limb and say that you're a Bill Murray fan.
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Good. We
I gotta say,
now. That's well, good.
Right now we've got that out of the way because it was really. I was worried you were gonna say no, and then the rest of the show was gonna be ruined. No, what I think is interesting about this book is that it does manage to it deals with a lot of serious subject matter, and especially in the parts leading up to when Ryan and David actually start the real quest portion. It's pretty fucking serious. Like, there, it's not that it's not fun. It is, but there's a lot of shit going on. So was it hard for you to be writing this book within your mind, you know where it's going, and you know that it's going to be... I'll say this. Like, I'm reading along, and then I get to the scene where... the two guys, I'm not going to name everybody because I feel like if I name all the characters, the listeners are going to get confused, okay? So the two guys are having their lunch or dinner in Japan, and someone comes, chugs the sake, throws down the money, and says, they'll never believe you. And you know, because of the title of the book, obviously, and if you know anything about, like, the internet culture, the mythos of Bill Murray, like, you knew that it was Bill Murray. And I immediately was grinning, like, I thought it was the best thing ever. But the moments before that happened were, like, deadly serious. So how did you find a way to balance that and make sure that you were being true to the parts of the story that were serious?
Yeah, like I said before, I really hate, like when I read something, like I feel like I'm being talked down to, or, you know, like the person's trying to push a message on me. So I wanted to make it fun and also, you know, include some serious stuff. So I tried to do that. I tried to, when I was getting serious, to also make sure it didn't get too serious and too preachy and too, you know, over the top.
I think that's a good idea, just in general, because that's kind of how life is. Life can be pretty serious, but, you know, there's still some fun parts. There's still something, hopefully, that's going to make you laugh every now and then. So I think if it's just drama on top of drama on top of sadness on top of misery, then it just becomes so almost unreal in that way that, okay, something happy, something funny has to happen in these people's lives. So, yeah, I think that really helped ground it. That was it.
What I think is interesting, too, is that even when but even when you have characters, like, just flat out debating a subject. Like, there's a part where David and Ryan are debating Ryan's church and the way that they spend their money and the way that they do their mission work. That both sides are being presented, and even though it starts to become clearer as the story progresses that Ryan is really, like, something is kind of going on that's pretty serious, in the beginning portions of this, like, he's completely logical. He's a normal guy. He has his beliefs, and everything is cool. And so you're not reading that particular debate and being like, oh, man, David is handing it to him. It's like two friends who genuinely care about each other that are having a contentious debate about something that a lot of people can't even talk about with family members. And at the end of it, they're still friends. They still care about each other. Like, they might need to cool off, but they come back and everything is cool. And I think that's really interesting, especially when you say, like, you're not trying to come off as preachy. It's just like there's a lot of presentation of ideas that happen in ways that they happen in our everyday life. Like, you just have a conversation with somebody. And surely, you know, in your life, you're going to run into somebody who feels passionately about something you feel passionately about but has the opposite opinion on it. And it's really hard not to get angry.
Right.
So following on that, another storyline that's going. Oh, okay. No, I'm gonna rewind. Nobody knows that I'm rewinding because they can't see my notes. But I'm gonna rewind. Was the Joe Jeffers bio in the book factual?
Yes, that was factual. The Jonesboro Church Wars, that was real.
Yeah, well, I knew that the Jonesboro stuff was real, and I knew who Joe Jeffers was, but reading like, you've given, like, a quick rundown of his life and how he got to where he was, and I was like, I have no idea about any of this. And that
I think that wasn't real. Like, that he was a comedian and whatnot. I think I invented that part.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's good to know then, because I was like, wow, that's crazy.
So you guys knew about the Jonesboro Church Wars before?
I had heard some of it. I know that I recognized some of the names that were at play, and I did remember hearing about the stuff that was going on in Jonesboro, which is like it caught my attention in that way of, like, you know, bells are ringing. I know that I know something about this, but I'm not sure what, which is why I was like, oh, man, I don't have any idea how much of this is factual and how much of it is embellished. So.
Kind of unbelievable, though, wasn't it? The whole situation. I just, when I read it, I was like, wow, this is really real. I cannot believe it.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, right, is I have this conversation with my husband a lot. It's like something will happen. And he'll be like, you should write a story about that. And I'd be like, nobody would ever, it would never make it through, like, beta readers. It would never make it through critique. Everyone would be like, no, that's too unbelievable. Because, you know, the joke is that, like, you know, fiction has to be believable, whereas reality, anything can fucking happen, you know?
Yeah.
The Joseph Pine story starts out like some of the most brutal crime fiction I've read recently, and I read some pretty brutal shit. We had an incredibly brutal novel that we talked about last week. So it was very interesting to me. Also, I should add that story was about like a hardened, horrible criminal turning into a preacher as well, which is weird. It's a new genre. Anyway, so Joseph Pine's story, I guess you hear a lot about, like, you know, the sex shop churches and the churches that cater directly towards people who are dealing with addiction or people who are, like, recovering from, you know, a criminal lifestyle or whatever it may be. But this Joseph Pine character kind of takes it to a whole different level. And I kind of have a couple questions about it. So I'll just, like, I'll throw them out there, and then I can, like, refresh your memory if you need me to. One, sure. Was this based on anything that you've actually seen? Is there, like, a TV preacher or a church that you had in mind? Two, do you think that somebody with a history, because I know the book doesn't all take place in the present day. So in today's world, do you think that somebody with Pine's history would be able to make it to where he is without people finding out about his past? Because I know that's kind of one of the plot points, is that if certain things get found out, he's done for, he's ruined.
Yeah.
So do you think it would, like, do you think that's a possibility anymore, or do you think that he would get sucked into the scandal machine just like everybody else?
Well, well, like, to answer the first question, the character was based on an actual preacher. I was raised Catholic, so I didn't see him in the Catholic church, but one of my friends in high school, you know, said, hey, you know, come on out and check out my church. And it was one of those, you know, Pentecostal kind of churches.
Oh, okay.
And people were being slain in the spirit, you know, in the aisle, and the guy was talking about silver and gold dust falling from the rafters, and I was just like, you know, blown away. Like, wow, what is going on here? This is some weird stuff. I didn't even know that world existed, you know?
Yeah.
And I went back a bunch more times, but yeah, it was based on a preacher that, like a traveling preacher that, that came through there one time. So he was a real guy, based on a real guy. But yeah, I think today he would probably be found out if he did those things in the present day, you know,
yeah,
with the internet and everything else. I'm sure he would be sucked into the scandal machine, as you said.
But then you have to also wonder if it would even matter, because one of the things that I brought up last week was that, like, David Berkowitz, the serial killer, runs a ministry from prison online, because why not? You know?
It's a testament to the power of God that he can change a serial killer or, you know, a drug addict.
It's funny, like you said, though, that you went to that church and you saw that. And you were like, I didn't even know this existed. I feel like there have been a few times in my life, not very many, because I think I'm a fairly open-minded person, but every once in a while I will encounter somebody who is doing something or who is expressing, we'll say, an opinion on a conspiracy theory or what have you, and I'll just be like, I didn't know that that was real. Like, I thought that that was something people said. Like, I know intellectually that there are people who believe that the Earth is 6,000 years old.
Yeah.
But when I actually met someone who believed that, who was a college-educated professional, like, I almost passed out in shock. Like, you're just like, I didn't really think that that was a thing. I thought that that was, you know, like, no, hearty har, let's make fun of the silly fundamentalist Christians. Like,
Oh, you should have seen me the day I found not one, but three people in my workplace that didn't believe that dinosaurs were, like, real.
Oh, jeez.
I was like, huh? I had never even heard of such a thing. Like, I just didn't, like, I didn't know that that was a theory or whatever it is you call that.
Yeah. Although I've heard them say that they're like satanic beasts, you know, that like Satan created the dinosaurs to trick us.
Yeah, that's it.
I've heard that.
And if that's what the devil's doing, I'm super not scared of the devil. That's a terrible plot.
The Brontosaurus.
That's like the lamest
ridiculous
plot
animal
ever. Put the bones in the ground and maybe you'll find them. What? Come on. They're not even tricking me into anything.
Yeah.
Other than like a April Fool's joke, maybe. Like, haha, not really.
Okay. Other than like millions of dollars in toys and movies.
Oh, that's what it is.
Yeah, it's really shocking too to leave the country and, you know, living in the States, I always just assumed that it was like that everywhere. You know, the dialogue on religion and the you know, political strife that religion causes. But like, it's not, you know, I talk to my buddies from the UK who live here and other places, and religion and politics are totally separate, and you don't have this, you know, this driving force of religion in that pervades every aspect of life, you know?
Yeah.
You kind of just have your religion and keep it.
Right. Because you mentioned the UK, and my husband's from England, and we go every couple of years. And, you know, it's not that England is like a godless nation. There's a lot of religion going on in England. But at the same time, like, the things that become religious issues in this country are just like, so what over there? You know,
yeah.
Like, the yearly Christmas special play that they put on for children. It's called a pantomime. It's not a pantomime, by the way, which I was happy to find out when I got taken to one, because I was really like, I don't think my kid is going to be down with mimes. But anyway, like, there's always things that have to happen in these pantomimes, and it's like a classic story, like a fairy tale. And there's always there's always a female character pretending to be a man, and there's always a big, like, John Waters-esque drag queen in a titular role in every single one of these. And they're for, like, preschool, like, maybe ages 3 to 10. That's the age bracket they're aimed at. And I remember we're sitting there, and there's, like, some really, really dirty jokes that get thrown out for the benefit of the parents. And I'm not talking about, like, you know, Shrek. I mean, like, this is... It could have been Divine up on the stage telling, you know. And it was so surreal to me, because I was like, man, if this happened, this is a nationwide thing. We went to see this play, like, across the street from frickin' Oxford University. Like, this is not, you know, some little thing that goes on in, like, some small community. It's nationwide.
Right.
If that happened in, like, Berkeley, there would still be, like, national news coverage of, like, you know, people would be protesting it, and don't you dare take my child on a school field trip to see the drag queens, and how dare you call this Christmas, and it's a fairy tale, it doesn't have anything to do with Christmas. Like, how crazy it would be if that happened anywhere in the U.S., let alone everywhere in the U.S. Like,
yeah, it's ridiculous.
That's not to say that they don't have their own issues. They do. But
sure.
But religion doesn't seem to be one of them for some reason. Which is even crazier when you consider, and maybe this is why, at least in England, like, they had such a huge, like, crazy rift in religion where people, like, literally had to, like, hide priests away in, like, the basement and stuff.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really that long ago. So I guess maybe if you have a history like that, you realize that it's very important to keep religion out of the hands of the government and keep it separate. I don't know.
Right.
So, yeah, once again, we just keep getting, like, no matter how hard I try, we keep coming back to the deep stuff, which I guess is a great compliment to your novel.
It is.
Thank you.
It is. But we've got, like, 15 minutes left, and we got to get to what made me want you on the show, which is, like, let's talk about Bill Murray.
Okay.
So I feel like we've established that the book is good and that there's a lot of other things going on aside from Bill Murray. But let's talk about Bill Murray, the man, the myth.
I really did read a review on I think it was Amazon or Goodreads, and it said, it was like a 5-star review, and it said they didn't read the book yet, but they saw it had something to do with Bill Murray, so they're like, yeah, absolutely, 5 stars. I thought, what? So I don't know what that's a testament to, I guess to Bill Murray, honestly, but that one kind of shocked me. The other reviews of people that read it were also very good.
Yes.
I saw that review, and then after a guy commented on it, like, you're ruining the rating system. You didn't even read the book.
Yeah.
And then I went and investigated the guy, and he was like, some of his other likes were like, interpreting the Bible literally, and, like, you know, saving the nation for Jesus. I'm like, oh, Christ.
We didn't want him to read the book.
I thought that was really funny. I'm sorry. And we're like, saving the nation for Jesus. Oh, Christ.
Oh.
No, so let's get down to the hard-hitting questions. Have you ever been to Punxsy for Groundhog Day? It's on my bucket list.
No, I haven't.
I met a guy. I was 20. When I was 20 years old, one of the guys who lived in my building when I was in the military was from Punxsutawney, and me and my other friend, who she and I are still really good friends to this day, we were just like, just tell us all about it. And he, did you know that it's a different groundhog every year?
Oh, is it really?
Trivia time. I felt like somebody told me Santa Claus wasn't real when I first found that out.
Hmm.
But no, like, they, because it may not be every year, but it's like a regular thing. They find the biggest, fattest groundhog, and then they like, there's an official groundhog caretaker who takes care of the groundhog until Groundhog's Day. And they make sure that he's, like, super fat. Like, that's his job, is to be as fat as possible.
Wow.
Which doesn't sound so bad, really. It's not like they eat him afterwards, you know?
How long do they live, anyway, groundhog?
I have no idea. That's a great question. I'm going to Google that later. So, one of the things that I thought was really fun, I guess, because I'm, you know, as it might be obvious, I'm a huge Bill Murray fan. You know, I'm a fan of his work, and I'm also a fan of, like, the persona, right? And it is a lot of things that, like, you just don't, you genuinely, you're like, I don't know if it's true. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. And that's something that happens a lot in the book, where people will be like, oh my God, I knew it. I knew it was true. So when faced with such a plethora of memes, I guess you'd call them, about Bill Murray, how did you choose the ones that you decided to feature in the book? Because there were a few.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing started, like, the Bill Murray angle on the book. I read, you know, one of the They'll Never Believe You stories. And I'm like,
right.
I really want to write a book, like, featuring that, you know, featuring Bill Murray going on a rampage with his Never Believe You. And it kind of just evolved into this. Just whatever I thought was fun and cool, you know, and the most Murray-esque I included in the book.
I do love that. I mean, like, that is probably my favorite. Well, no, they're my two favorites. One is the French fry story, They'll Never Believe You. And the other was, and there was photographic evidence of this one, that for a while, I don't know how long, he went around, like, New York City in the evenings and just, like, crashed people's house parties. Like, he just, like, he'd, you know, be, like, wandering through an apartment building and he'd hear music and knock on the door and be like, yeah, I'm here to party.
Yeah.
Like, how would you even respond to that, right? Like, I feel like for a full 10-15 minutes after that happened, it would be the lamest party ever, because everyone would just be like, holy fucking shit, that just happened.
Yeah.
The other thing, I guess, that I feel like is a big question is when you, because Bill Murray is a character in the book eventually, as well as some other well-known celebrities that have, like, a persona that they're known for, right?
Right.
So was it hard or challenging in any way to fictionalize someone knowing that, well, one, people buying the book are going to be familiar with that persona, and they probably have an attachment to it. And two, that it has to be believable, and you have to kind of, like, you're assigning actions and emotions and whatever to someone who is actually, does actually exist, but doesn't, it, you know, but it's not a factual story.
Right. Yeah, that was something I was also kind of wanted the book to speak to, like, our obsession with celebrity. And I feel the same way about Bill Murray, but I think we have these celebrities that we kind of feel like we know, you know, and we have an emotional connection to already. And for me, that's Bill Murray and a couple of the other people in the book. And like I said, we almost feel like we know them, like they're real people in our lives. So it wasn't that hard to write fictionally about a real person, because I think I feel like I already know these people. You know, I've grown up with Bill Murray. I've watched his movies a million times. I read about him. I feel like I know him already. Yeah. I wanted the novels to represent that too, to speak to that, like our own obsession with celebrity. Like, we don't know these people. They don't know us from anyone else, you know, but we have this deep emotional connection to them. I think that's strange.
Yeah. Well, you know, but I feel like I get it for some people and I don't get it for others. And And not necessarily just for people that I like, because, like, I can understand why people feel an emotional connection to musicians, because that's kind of what music is all about, right? So I might hate a particular artist's music, but I get why, like, you might feel an emotional connection to that artist. And I feel like with Bill Murray, what you have is somebody whose career has spanned decades. And most of his work has been stuff that is iconic and that, like, brings people joy, right?
Oh, yeah,
like,
sure.
You can love whatever movie he's in, and it could be even your favorite movie, but then someone else, like, I don't know, for instance, me, like, I was super into the Ghostbusters when I was a kid because my uncles were into it, and I spent a lot of time with my uncles. And, like, I have memories of playing with, like, the Ghostbusters Play-Doh set and having my little Ecto-1 and, you know, Slimer toy.
Yeah, yeah.
That was part of my childhood, you know.
Right.
And then, you know, on the flip side of it, you know, I went through a terrible divorce, and I literally, like, I needed, you know, something basically to fall asleep to at night, and I watched Groundhog Day, like, every night for, like, a month, month and a half. I finally stopped when I started dreaming about Groundhog Day, and I switched to something else. I think I switched to Dodgeball, which is not quite comparable in quality, but, you know, just mindless, funny, whatever. So, you know, to me, like, when Bill Murray goes, like, when Harold Ramis died, it was pretty tough for me. But when Bill Murray goes, it's going to be even more tough because he is on the screen all the time. Whereas Harold Ramis was, you know, he was behind the scenes on a lot of great things and only on the screen for a few things. And also he does have, I feel like to an extent he cultivates the persona that people associate with it, like the real Bill Murray. You know, like the golfing stuff and the weird facial hair and, you know, going to random parties just because he can. PBR, golf pants, like, you know, like he likes being the Bill Murray as opposed to just Bill Murray, you know?
Right.
But yeah, like, I'll never understand why people are, like, super into Channing Tatum. Like, I'm like, he looks funny.
Right.
He's not that great of an actor, you know?
True.
So, yeah, I don't know. But, I guess I have to ask, what's your favorite Bill Murray movie? Like, if you're on the spot right now, you live or die.
What about Bob, I think, for sure.
Oh, yeah. That's criminally underrated film.
Yeah.
Nobody ever says that.
Genius.
But you might be right. Hmm. You just flipped my whole world upside down. Jessica, what's your favorite?
Oh, I didn't think you'd ask me.
I always ask.
I know, but for some reason I thought I was going to get out of this one. That is really hard, and I honestly, I don't know what to say. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what my favorite is.
It's hard. I'm not.
I'm disappointing.
You know, I'm going to go with, it's hard. It's hard, but for the sake of saying a movie we haven't mentioned yet, I'm tipping to Stripes because, like, I was in the military, so, like,
I wouldn't have even thought of that one, actually. Yeah, okay.
And we used to say that all the time. We always used to be like, lighten up, Francis. Because, I mean, like, this may come as a surprise to you, but some Marines take themselves too seriously.
I work with a bunch of Marines, I know.
Yeah.
it's not like an epidemic or anything, except for that it totally is. We only have a couple minutes left.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. I know. Is Owen Wilson really called the Butterscotch Stallion, or did you make that up?
Yes, he's actually called the Butterscotch Stallion.
What? Why?
Oh, I can't say in the company of ladies, but if you go on the internet and Google it, you'll see why.
I can't.
I'm going to Google it right now. Hold on.
Okay. I was going to say, I'm too afraid.
I don't think anything bad will come up, but it might be just a legend or a meme, but I think I remember reading it.
It was a suggested search. As soon as I got Butterscotch Stallion O, it was like, oh.
You mean Owen Wilson?
Oh. Nickname given to him by a gossip column reader, Owen has butterscotch hair and is said to be pecking like a stallion, ladies. Except we've already discussed it. A lot of
oh,
actually
my.
Care.
That's exciting. Maybe? I don't know.
You know what's funny?
Do you remember when Owen Wilson tried to kill himself?
Yeah.
No, I do. Because I just
Wasn't
saw that.
Wasn't that weird?
You know what's weirder? I was just going to say this. It's so weird. It's like you and I are connected. We've been doing the show too long. You know how when you see a Google preview, when you search for like certain keywords, like it breaks up the previews that you see all your search for words?
Yeah.
This is what it says. The hospitalization this week of Owen Wilson, 38, after police awarded Wilson the moniker the Butterscotch Stallion, I'm pretty sure that's not how it went down.
You never know. Could be it.
Wow.
We shouldn't be laughing about that, but it's...
Yeah,
I didn't do it. Google did
it,
okay? Take it up with Google. Take it up with Ray Kurzweil. Okay, so this week... Danielle has found this music by a band called Motherfolk, which is like the weirdest name for a band ever, isn't it?
It's called what?
Motherfolk.
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 Like
Motherfolk.
Like
right,
folk
but you know, it's like
with a mother in front.
Right?
Yeah.
Like a swear. I get it. It's like a swear
right.
word. Gotcha.
Mm. I guess it's supposed to like say it really fast or with an accent. Oh. I don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, the name of the song is called Hiccuped, which is also kind of weird. Like, I don't know. This whole thing is weird. But I feel like it's fitting. Because it's weird, not like because it has anything to do with anything we've discussed.
Just because we don't understand it. No. That's a terrible thing, anyway.
And our sponsor this week, as I mentioned at the top of the show, was High Octane Damnation, which, is a novel by Brett Williams coming at us from Comet Press. And I didn't read what it was about last time. I just read some amazing blurbs. So this time I'm going to tell you what it's about. James McGuire is drowning his sorrows at a bar when a stranger offers him the unimaginable. The keys to his dream car and the opportunity to redirect his anger at the man who killed his family. But revenge is only the first stop on the highway to hell. A mob of women as mad as James are set on destruction, and they will do whatever it takes to get what they want. James McGuire, though, remains determined to stay behind the wheel on his trip to high-octane damnation. I added the echo myself. That wasn't in the thing. But, yeah.
You did that? Oh, man. Sounded professional.
Let's see. I want to make sure there was all these great blurbs, and then I think that I hit them all already last week, and I thought I had left some for this week, and now I'm sad.
You didn't.
I didn't. Okay, well, you know, I'm going to go over a second one.
Okay.
Over the top, full throttle, no apologies, grindhouse. Blood soaked and sex fueled. Those are some great blurbs. Tom Hanks, whatever. Great blurbs for the book, and as usual, if you click the banner at the bottom of the episode notes, you'll see where to buy that. And as always, if you click the picture, actually, this is great. I never thought I'd be able to say this on the show. If you click the picture of Bill Murray's face, the episode notes will take you to Joshua's book, and you can read all about saving Bill Murray. And hopefully what you've taken from this episode is that there is a lot going on in this book, and it's deep, it's complex, it's hilarious, and I think it touches that part of everyone's heart that just genuinely loves Bill Murray. because why wouldn't you? Thanks so much for doing the show, and thanks, you know, making time for us. Josh is all the way in Korea, so.
Can I mention my next book coming out? I'm not sure when. It's going to be called Wine Tasting is Bullshit. And it should be out by next fall, I'm hoping. Just looking, it's with an agent now, just looking for a publisher, so.
Fantastic.
Get in touch.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah,
get in touch and mess out, and we'll see you again. Well, I sat on the edge of a cliff with you, and you said, go ahead, they won't miss you when you are dead. Places where it needed to bleed, and my head torn apart, and my soul is just begging. My